Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 18. As Callie drove home, the thick, ominous clouds lowering the sky looked capable of crushing her at any minute. She barely noticed, though, because her thoughts threatened to do the same thing. So many unanswered whys now filled her mind that they threatened to incapacitate her. "Callie, you're never going to know why some things happen," Alicia had reminded her during their final visit. "That's the way life is. You have to stop thinking and just accept it." But Callie couldn't. She'd filled her head with the what's, how's, where's, who's, and when's, specifically so she could understand the why's. Without that final answer, all the rest became so much useless process. So many useless facts taking up her time and energy without telling her what she needed to know. Maybe that was enough for Alicia, but it wasn't enough for her. Callie clutched the steering wheel so hard her fingers ached, fighting the awareness that she'd wasted years in therapy trying to find an answer her therapist never believed existed. But more than that, she fought the acceptance of what had kept her from knowing the answers to all those whys. Fear. If only somewhere along the line she had found the courage to ask, "Mom, why do you dress up like Venus and dance through the house? Dad, why won't you talk to me? Uncle George, why do you touch me there? Zed, why does my success so frighten you?" Then she might have known. But by the time she gained the courage to ask those questions and accept the answers, the whos were all gone, and her parents had left her with the biggest why of all. Why did they set Billy up to find them like that? During their last meeting, Alicia also reminded Callie to expect to cycle through denial, anger, bargaining, and depression before she finally accepted her parents' death. She said this so authoritatively, Callie felt compelled to ask, "Has anyone close to you ever died?" Alicia made a tent with her fingers and precisely aligned her perfectly manicured nails before she disclosed, "My dog died when I was 6. "What did you do?" The tent trembled slightly. "I swore I'd never get another pet." "Did you?" Callie asked. "No, I never did." Then Callie knew that Alicia was as frightened as she was. Without Billy and all the cats to care for, Callie had no idea what to do with herself when she entered the house. Once she removed her coat, she automatically went to the cat room and stood in the doorway, looking at all the empty little beds. "You're in denial," she heard Alicia say. "I am not in denial," Callie countered, feeling a terrible rage building within her. She picked up a stainless steel water bowl and threw it at the wall as hard as she could. "I am fucking mad!" And then she lost it. She grabbed all the litter pans and hurled them across the room with enough force that they disintegrated when they hit the walls. She swept all the little pillows off all the little shelves and benches and jumped up and down on them, screaming, "I hate you! I hate all of you! Why did you die? Why did you leave me?" She ripped the custom-made drapes off the windows, kicked the heater until her legs ached, slashed open bags of dried food, and beat on cans of food with a can opener, spraying food everywhere and cutting her hands on the battered metal. And when nothing remained for her to destroy, she threw herself down on the debris-strewn floor and lay pounding her fists, kicking and screaming like a maniac because she didn't know what else to do. One benefit of living alone is that, when you make an ass of yourself and finally realize it, you can just get up and stagger away without having to explain your behavior. Callie staggered into the living room and sank to the floor next to the cold wood stove, where she picked cat food and litter out of her hair with her battered hands until the phone rang. "Callie, are you all right?" asked Joe. "No, I'm not all right. All the cats are dead, and so is Billy." "Cats? What cats?" "The 30 cats who made me crazy and kept me sane," she said, and hung up. Joe arrived about 20 minutes later, took one look at her, and followed the trail of litter and food to the cat room. When he returned, he sat down on the floor beside her. "You don't do things halfway, do you?" he remarked, brushing some litter off her sleeve while Curly licked cat food off her skirt. She nodded without looking at him, and then he told her what she'd already surmised. "There was a mouse nest clogging the heater vent pipe. Didn't you check it before you turned it on?" "I asked Billy to check it because it hadn't been used for months, but I thought he knew." She stopped, then repeated the Billy defense she'd summoned so many times over the years. He always seemed to know so much more than people gave him credit for. Callie, he was a handyman, a deaf-mute one with the mind of a child, not a heating contractor. Joe put his arm around her. "You need a keeper. You know that? You live in your own little world just like he did." They sat like that until the cold caused her to shiver. "Get cleaned up and into bed while I build a fire," he ordered. "You're exhausted." "I don't want to go to bed." She resisted his proposal as all the reasons why she couldn't fill her mind. "I can't go without. It's too empty." She stopped and looked at him, feeling like a complete fool. "You worry too much," he said, pulling her to her feet. By the time she got out of the shower, he'd built a fire and put every blanket he could find on her bed. When she crawled in, he crawled in with her and wrapped his warm body around her chilled one and massaged her back until she relaxed. "It's all right if you want to, you know, do it," she told him, feeling she owed him something for his concern. "Not now," he murmured into the top of her head. "Not this way." The next morning, Callie awoke to an odd lip-smacking noise. Feeling warm and comfortable, she rolled over and came face to face with Curly, trying to lick powdered sugar from his curly whiskers. She knew it was powdered sugar because the little slobbery pieces of the donut from whence it came were all over her, or rather Curly's and her, pillow. She could also see the plate that at one time had held the donut on the bedside table. Next to it stood a glass of orange juice, against which a sheet of paper leaned in such a way that she could easily read the message written on it. "Please be kind and don't tell me that you didn't notice when I left and the dog took my place." She laughed, rolled over, and went back to sleep. Callie slept until late afternoon when hunger awoke her. In the kitchen, she found exactly what you'd expect to find in a kitchen of someone whose mind had been somewhere else for weeks. Nothing. Aside from wild bird seed and a few cans of cat food she had missed in her rampage, nothing edible presented itself except some condiments and a container of shriveled vegetarian lasagna she had heated and forgotten in the microwave at least twice. "Time to take you home and do some grocery shopping," she announced to Curly, who leaped into the air in delight. Only when she left the house did it dawn on Callie that the predicted storm had come the previous night and someone had plowed her driveway. If tradition held, that meant that the new wood guy had assumed this old wood guy task too. She made a mental note to tell the new wood guy that, unlike her parents, she would do the job herself. It seemed pretty clear to her by then that she had a habit of latching on to others, of all species, to help her deal with things she ought to be able to handle on her own. She then became dependent on them, and when they left her, as they invariably did, she felt more lost and vulnerable than ever. "It's time to break that unproductive pattern," she told Curly, using one of Alicia's favorite maxims. Life consists of patterns like the trails on an Uncle Wiggily game board, the therapist had explained as she watched children playing in the schoolyard next to her office. "Some trails serve us better than others. You must eliminate those that don't work for you, Callie."
"Life reminds me more of Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken," Callie had replied in an effort to summon a more workable analogy than a childhood game she had never played. "We all must choose which road to take." Admittedly, she had purloined this observation from her seventh-grade English teacher, but it seemed to fit.
"No," countered Alicia, "life is not a road. It is a song sung by an idiot." Realizing that the sight of the playing children had carried Alicia's thoughts away from her patient and into the realm where she could burst into tears and start talking about Rex's sperm any minute, Callie quickly agreed. "You're right. I need to eliminate those idiotic patterns."
With that thought in mind, Callie loaded Curly into the van and headed to Joe's. Unfortunately, Joe wasn't home, and she didn't feel comfortable leaving the dog there without telling him. Visions of Curly starving to death while his owner engaged in some protracted tryst with Justine filled her mind. True, she had no reason to believe this. Well, no reason except that he was a single male who lived within a 50-mile radius of Justine. Callie next stopped at the pizzeria, and Curly immediately started wagging his tail when he saw Joe's truck, which he didn't even recognize at first because of the plow on it. "You wait here," she told the dog, "while I go find your daddy in the bar." Inside, she scanned the room and located Joe holding court in a back booth with Justine and two other women. Rather than march over and publicly announce her desire to relieve herself of his dog, she leaned against the wall and observed the mating rituals in hopes of catching his eye. However, as Justine repeatedly rubbed his arm and did God only knows what to him under the table, she decided to take the dog back home. Joe caught up with her just as she reached the van. "Did you want to talk to me?" he asked. "I wanted to return your dog, but I didn't want to interfere with your sex life to do it," she answered. "I suppose that means you won't have a beer with me?" "If I wanted to be part of a harem, I would have stayed in Utah," she replied, then added, "Where do you want Curly, in your truck or at home? I don't want him to freeze or starve to death waiting for you." "Why don't you keep him?" "Because he's not my dog." "I know, but maybe you could use a dog right now." She opened the door and let the jubilant dog out to greet his master. "Sorry, Joe," she told him as she got into the van. "No more pets for me."
You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.